Reflections 7. Religious Reconciliation and Theopraxy's Seven Tenets. Historically, attempts at conciliation between religions have taken two forms. One has been to adopt the liberal ideals of tolerance, fairness, universal human rights, and respect for all racial and cultural differences. When the object is interdenominational Christian unity, it is called ecumenicism. When extended to all religions, it is called the interfaith movement. The second form of conciliation has been more philosophical. It entails asserting that beneath apparent differences in ritual and language, all religions really worship the same God, i.e., the one and only God in whose eyes, conversely, all humanity is one big family. This view is propounded by Universalist Unitarians, Baha'i, by popular mythologists like Joseph Campbell, by historians of religion like Houston Smith, and by prime ministers and presidents, at least in public, as well as by most Jewish, Christian, and Muslim public intellectuals. While respecting the virtues of these two approaches, when they're sincere, the theology of theopraxy looks for conciliation between religions on more meaningful grounds, grounds requiring more than live-and-let-live tolerance on the one hand, or veiled assertions of the supremacy of you-know-who's God on the other. The theology of theopraxy, as the reader well knows, takes a more metaphysical stance, namely that free moral praxis is God. This means that old religions, in their attempt to be modern, should not have to jettison their core rituals and narratives just to make them agree with the latest biological, cosmological, or archaeological findings. Nor should they be forced to admit that their beliefs and rituals are merely useful fictions, which has been the sociologist's view of them since Durkheim, and before that, Feuerbach and Nietzsche. Such admissions would be self-defeating, not to say injurious, for the greater number of their followers, who suspect it anyway, prefer it unspoken, and who are wise enough to see that these fictions are to be taken with considerable, if not complete, seriousness. The theology of theopraxy takes the common sense acceptance a step further. The core narratives and beliefs of each religion, it says, genuinely are constitutive of God in idea and often conducive to God in actuality. Many, if not most, ordinary, decent, half-believing people are adherents already, but don't know it. Like Santayana, John Dewey wanted to, quote, emancipate the religious from religion. And what is the religious? In his book A Common Faith of 1934, Dewey formulates it carefully, quote, an activity pursued in behalf of an ideal end, against obstacles and in spite of threats of personal loss, because of conviction of its general and enduring value, is religious in quality. As we heard it argued earlier in Arguments 19 by Feuerbach and Evans, Dewey argued that ideals such as love, compassion, justice, and so on could be pursued without belief in supernatural agency, that is, without belief in God. And of course, Dewey is right. No all-powerful, all-seeing, all-caring creator God need be posited in order to bring out the best in humankind. And forcing people to believe in this God is certainly counterproductive. But this does not prove that out-and-out secularism is the alternative. Nor does it prove that natural piety toward the kind of world science discloses, a prescription which is at the core of deism, is the best of alternatives. There are other theisms, pantheism and panentheism, for example. And then there is the theology of theopraxy, which says that the God to whom good and devout Jews, Christians, and Muslims pray, and whom they obey, is real. He, quote unquote, it's just not real in the way the literature of mainstream Judaism, Christianity, and Islam say God is. How, then, is God real? In Declarations 11, I try to convey how in poetic terms. In Explanations 4, I offer a more discursive answer. Here, let me reply in the light of what has been discussed since, and offer the first draft of what might be called the seven tenets of the theology of theopraxy. Tenet 1. God is not a person or thing or principle or spirit. God is activity of a certain sort, namely, the free doing of good, whereby good we mean that which preserves, honors, and promotes all forms and instances of life. Tenet 2. God was not the creator, nor is God all-powerful or omniscient. God is the newest and weakest force in the universe, a human production, even as God, good doing, produces humaneness in turn. Tenet 3. Freedom is necessary to doing good, and good doing is necessary to producing more freedom. Tenet 4. Science is the friend of true religion, which is faith justified by works. Tenet 5. The development of ever fairer and more compassionate laws, as well as more broadly life-sustaining social and cultural practices, is God's mandate and our task. Tenet 6. Long-evolved religions present powerful and highly specific rituals, images, arguments, narratives, and commandments whose purpose is to affect Tenet 5, and can be respected and practiced without significant alteration when they succeed in doing so. Tenet 7. Both the idea and substance of God remain open to evolution. Reflections 8. Study and Practice. Could someone raised completely without religious instruction benefit from the theology of theopraxy, or at least find that it makes sense? Further to Reflections 4, I think the answer is yes. Although theopraxy benefits from an emotional tie to, or knowledge of, and respect of at least one religion, it's not a requirement. Most people know what the word God means, even irreligious people. To say, "I don't believe in God," or "I don't go in for all that religious stuff," is still not the same as saying, what is this word? Knowing what the word God means does not vouch that one has had a religious experience, of course. But it's a start. Many people disaffected by organized religion will say that they are spiritual, but not religious. That, too, is a start. But the best start is this. Nearly everyone, with or without a formal religious background, knows what moral goodness feels like, and this in a powerful and primitive way that probably goes back to early childhood, in experiences of generosity, say, or further back still, to our neural wiring. And because of that, the theology of theopraxy might offer a way toward a religious tradition for many non-believers, and a way back to a religious tradition for many believers in exile. By seeing how it is that God is the good we do, both kinds of people are able to see that the narratives and doctrines of traditional religions are less descriptions of historical fact, and thus mostly wrong, than allegories about goodness's historical emergence from barbarism, and thus mostly right. These are allegories urging us in this always modern day to realize the potential we have to freely choose and do what is best for all. How can someone without much religious background, but with a strong feeling of what goodness means, be awakened to the notion of theopraxy? Can one train in theopraxy? I think the answer is yes, in two rather ordinary ways. Study and, well, practice, in the sense of repeating an exercise leading to proficiency. First, study. This means learning more about a religion, preferably one's own family's religion. One might attend services, go to Sunday school, read books, talk to parents and grandparents. One might also take courses in comparative religion. The aim, anyway, is to come to a genuinely emotional and intellectual appreciation of the glory of God as traditionally conceived. For if the theology of theopraxy is to have something to which to apply itself, it helps to respect the majestic conception of God, or Allah, Brahman, Tao, or the way of heaven, that drives all the great religions. In order to transform scriptural accounts of God into the grounds for autonomous ethical action without literal belief in that God, it helps to appreciate the passion of the prophets and the wisdom of religious philosophers. After all, an interpreter starts with something to interpret, as well as an understanding of what the author or speaker is getting at. No less important is studying the basic concepts and arguments of secular moral philosophy, whose conclusions are rarely at odds with religions. There, concepts such as fairness, goodness, justice, altruism, wrongdoing, and so forth, are richly discussed, to put it mildly, with minimum mention of God or none at all, which exercise itself is salutary, regardless of one's intuitions about God's part in all of this, or the manner of his existence. Second is practice. If we are to understand how God is in our hands, we must first know what it's like to have anything in our hands. That is, what it's like for something consequential to be up to us. Sadly, not everyone has had this experience. Many are accustomed to seeing themselves only as reactors, not actors, as responders, not initiators. So the second mode of training, if one might call it that, for theopraxy, might be first-hand experience of creative moral action and of creative activity in general. One must learn what it feels like to make things, be they artifacts, drawings, or arrangements, as well as to make things happen, events, occasions. One must learn how to take responsibility both for that making and to the thing or event made. One must understand the dynamics of projects done together or alone, as follower or leader. But in either case, one must know what it feels like to turn a plan into a deed by one's own acts, one's own choices and will. How might one do all this? Assume a cold start. One could begin with a project in art, make something beautiful, or in social intervention, do something good. With gardening, help something grow. With writing, write something interesting. Or even cooking, cook something tasty. In all these cases, the vagueness of the word something is essential, because it forces the trainee to choose what exactly their project will consist of, and then to take autonomous steps towards bringing it about. Later, such projects become self-assigned. There is no lower or upper age limit for beginning this training. In God, human creativity, morality, and autonomy are one. Life-enhancing action becomes theopraxy. Of the closeness of God in practice, in contrast to the remoteness of God in doctrine, Moses said to his flock, in Deuteronomy 30:11-14, the following: "Surely this instruction which I enjoin upon you this day is not too baffling for you, nor is it beyond reach. It is not in the heavens that you should say, 'Who among us can go up to the heavens and get it for us and impart it to us that we may observe it?' Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, 'Who among us can cross to the other side of the sea and get it for us and impart it to us that we may observe it?' No, the thing is very close to you, in your mouth and in your hearts to observe it." With study and practice, one realizes how it is that God is in our hands, how it is that whether or not God exists is entirely up to us. One comes to appreciate the gravity of these claims and the unexpected grandeur of their modest promise to us. Do good, do it yourself, do it because you want to, and the heavens will rejoice. Reflections 9. The Situation of Atheists. Atheists are convinced that God does not exist in any objective sense, which is to say that God does not really exist. They believe that people invented God in order to motivate each other to be good, to console each other in grief, and so on. At best, they say, God is a moral fiction. Believers, of course, would never go along with the demotion of God from fact to fiction, even though the claim makes disturbing sense. Indeed, it is precisely in order to head off this always possible demotion of God from resplendent king of the universe to salutary figment of the imagination that organized Western religion so strongly and insistently perpetuates belief not only in God objective, but in God massively, grandly objective. Creator of the universe, all glory beyond comprehension, except that he clearly chose Israel, sacrificed his only son for our sakes, made Muhammad his last prophet, etc., etc. Say atheists, efforts to impress God upon hoi polloi using such overwhelming means do more harm than good. When not serving the powerful or fanning hatred, they cloud reason, obstruct science, and breed passivity. The atheist's worries are, alas, all too often justified. Having bad ideas of God can have consequences worse than having no idea of God at all. But seekers of the theopracticing life are likely to believe that the good done by belief in God has, on the whole, outweighed the harm. Absent religion, we ask, would the same wars, purges, and murders not have been committed for other reasons? We'll never know. Perhaps religious differences have always been a cover for installing and then perpetuating ethnic and economic inequalities, a way of legitimating them, of sanctifying them. As the strategies of Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, and a dozen other anti-religious warlords attest, however, there are many ways other than calling on God to keep the disadvantaged at a disadvantage, the credulous obedient, and the poor grateful for what little they have. Atheists, on the other hand, if they are intellectually honest, are obliged to be grateful for the teachings of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, of Hammurabi, Confucius, Lao Tse, Moses, Solomon, the prophets of ancient Israel, of Jesus and Muhammad, Aquinas, Augustine, and Maimonides, to name a few of the classic teachers. Most of their teachings are now written into secular law, into state constitutions, and into the social fabric as everyday human decency, including the atheists. In more recent times, philosophers have wrestled with trying to square religious faith with experience and with science, and in that striving have produced the very body of thought upon which atheists rest their case. Immanuel Kant, Tom Paine, John Stuart Mill, Thomas Jefferson, Bertrand Russell, William James, and John Dewey, to name just a few prominent non-theists of the last few centuries, wrote what they wrote and said what they said, embedded in a Christian milieu whose basic moral principles they accepted and by whose narratives they were suitably moved. So were Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne. And if diehard atheists trying to circumvent the Bible were to go back to the philosophers of ancient Greece in search of examples of lives of pure reason, they would come across Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle paying respect to the gods, their gods, smiling and with easy hearts. Ironically, atheists who really understand the traditions they oppose might be in a better position to reach an understanding of God through the theology of theopraxy than those who are unthinkingly faithful. But good atheists, i.e. already theopracticing, might well be prevented from reaching that understanding by an emotional, personal need to reject their religious heritage. Don't all smart teenagers scoff at the lies that civility is based upon? Don't they all smirk at the foolishness of ordinary people, read their parents and their parents' friends, for not cottoning on to the contradictions of faith or for the failings of church leadership? Atheists are wont to believe, one, that intelligence and illusion are simple adversaries. Two, that in this world there are only material things, energy, and nothing. Three, that what most people do with their lives doesn't amount to a hill of beans in the larger scheme of things, i.e. no all-seeing, caring God to tally minutiae. And four, that commitment to human ideals in the face of life's absurdity is either pointless or misguided. My point? How frozen in youthfulness these opinions are. For a start, intelligence is no protection from illusion. Indeed, as often as not, intelligence is illusion's sponsor. For another, the category of information is far deeper than that of matter or energy. The universe is mindless and stupid, a cosmic screensaver generated by a line or two of code playing itself out over arbitrarily large dimensions. But the universe is smaller than a pea in the realm of what matters, which is what lies behind every pair of eyes that see, and is vast. And finally, in fact, nothing is more godly than creating meaning in a world that would otherwise be without it. Tragically, atheists tend not to see the closeness of what they are rightfully calling for, rationality, intelligence, honesty to goodness, responsibility, creativity, and courage in an indifferent universe, with what they are inveighing against, namely, a relationship to God. Theopraxy needs no theology to get it going or to back it up, although clearly I think it benefits from one. Theopraxy needs no faith in God, ordinary or extraordinary, although faith of some kind may help. In the view of our theology, atheists undo atheism with every good deed they do, just as believers undo God with every bad one. Reflections 10. The First Commandment. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. This is the first of the Ten Commandments. Does our theology obey it? Traditional believers would say, absolutely not, since the me referred to here is none other than the God who spoke to Abraham, who parted the Red Sea, who appeared to Moses at Sinai, who stopped the sun above Jericho, who took Isaiah and Jesus to his bosom, who guided Muhammad through the angel Gabriel, and so forth. They might also point to Tenet 7 of Reflection 7 as evidence. Both the idea and substance of God remain open to evolution. This is not the one God of the Torah, the Gospels, or Quran, nor for that matter is it Brahman or the Tao. In its own view, however, the theology of theopraxy does not break the first commandment. Why? Because it sees God of the Bible, specifically, as a character from the outset, demanding in Exodus 23 that no other gods be esteemed more highly than himself, and later that Israel have no other god at all, period. But as many Bible scholars have pointed out, God changes in name, image, character, and modus operandi across the span of the Bible itself. From patriarch to liberator, from liberator to lawgiver, from nearby spirit to remote principle, from mighty creator-destroyer to pan-human father, and thence to love itself. How could it be otherwise? Knowledge grows. History transforms mental as well as physical landscapes. Inasmuch as later gods, Heavenly Father and Yahweh, supplant earlier ones, El Shaddai and Elohim, the Bible itself, it would seem, breaks the first commandment. Of course, one might answer that it is our understanding of God that changes and evolves, not God. Or one might answer that God deliberately changes how he presents himself to us, according to what we are capable of understanding. But these answers come very close to staking out a difference that makes no difference. For if God is unknowable in full, as traditional believers agree, then God's immutability might be just one more thing we think we know about God, but don't. We might also be wrong about whether we can know God in full, for perhaps we can. Insisting that we cannot know God in full, rather than betokening intellectual humility, might be a convenient evasion of the responsibility that would surely fall upon our shoulders if we could understand God completely. Perhaps there is nothing simpler than knowing God. Perhaps we know what God wants all too well. Take away all the perhapses, and you have the theology of theopraxy's view. Besides, even if we hold that all of the above understandings of God, traditional and heretical, are given to us by God in the first place, they can still change. For God, as traditionally conceived, need only so will it. God might say, "See how I change," and change. Indeed, if the Bible is God's word, then perhaps God is already saying that, and changing too. The possibilities are dizzying. Intuition tells us, however, that something about God must stay constant for God to be God. The question is, what might that something be? You know what the theology of theopraxy answers. It is God's goodness, as embodied in our free actions. This is what never changes. Because good actions vary in detail in the way they preserve, honor, or promote life, so too do the specific actions that constitute God vary in detail from place to place and from situation to situation. Here it is a favor offered, there it is a favor refused. Here it is more justice, there it is more mercy. Here it is writing a book, there it is digging a well. This accounts for God's changeability. But in every case that good is done, God is brought to life. Ironically, God, as the theology of theopraxy wants us to understand God, i.e. as the good we do, could safely be the one God before whom no others should be had. I say safely because all other conceptions of God permit evil to be part of God or God's will. So parsimonious, so to the point, is theology of theopraxy's description of God, and difficult to corrupt by definition, for if an action is not good, it is not God, that it could well be the best understanding available today of the one God who has been God all along, who does not change what he wants or what he does. Agree, forgive a bit of personification, and the first commandment is restored to its rightful place. In fact, suspicion is cast the other way. You may well find these last few claims a bit much. Set them aside. We can reflect fruitfully on the first commandment without them, starting with a biblical understanding of God. Recall that the value of that understanding is not challenged. The first commandment from God to humankind was given as the first commandment from Moses to the Hebrews, to the chosen people, and only to them. But no less was it the first demandment from the Hebrews to God, the chosen one, in return. Quote, "Thou shalt have no other people before us, because of all the gods, you are the one we choose." That was the pact. That was the contract, the covenant. And covenants work two ways. Moses' innovation was not without its inherent problems. The God of Israel might be addressed as the Lord of Gods, our God, King of the Universe, but the very fact of God's entering into a doubly binding contract with humans, albeit with a small group of them, brings God down from ineffability and down, too, from supreme kingship. Kings don't deal. Kings don't have to keep their word to ordinary people unless they want to. God could overturn anything and everything at will. God can retract any promise and laugh at our consternation. But, according to Moses, he would not. God would consider himself bound. This was the miracle, the gift above all gifts, the Lord God's protection in return for loyalty and obedience to his laws. And thus was general moral law brought under contract law, albeit a very special contract. Thus, too, by the same token, were all contracts given divine spark. All keeping of promises, all acts of honor and loyalty, all fairness, all debate and agreement between men, all justice and good business became part of religion's concern. God would become intimately involved in morality and in daily life. And so it remained for millennia, until today, when we have a choice. Either God is dead, and we are guided merely by conscience, nature, and the edifice of law, or God is alive in and as every free act that preserves, honors, and promotes all life, or that inspires the construction of new law with that goal in mind. You know which I choose. Returning to history, on the largest view, says the theology of theopraxy, accepting the lordship of Yahweh was the means by which a people, the people of Israel, made a covenant with itself, a covenant between the wise and the foolish, and the old and the young, to establish and preserve the ethical life down through the generations of Israel. This is one interpretation. Says the traditional believer of the same set of events at Sinai, thus was Israel the means by which God made a covenant with himself, promising himself, committing himself to care for his people on the condition of their obedience to his law. This is another interpretation. Both are good. But here is the third interpretation. The truth of this event is that the Jews were not the chosen people. They were the choosing people. They were not elect of God, but elected God. They were not God's first choice among peoples, but the first people to choose God among the scores of gods that were worshipped in ancient Mesopotamia and the scores more that were worshipped in Egypt. The Hebrews chose there to be one God, the one who was Lord of all gods, the one who created everything in heaven, everything on earth, and everything in between. The world could no longer be accepted as incoherent, that incoherence blamed on irresolvable conflicts between multiple gods, or later, substances. It now had one explanation, one consistency, one purpose, one set of laws, one beginning, and one end. It would be centuries before the intuition of oneness would translate into the faith of kings and prophets, and millennia before it would translate into the faith of scientists, who all too easily forget its origin. Reflections 11. The unsettled referent of the word God. It might seem that our theology wants to have it all ways. It wants to combine the skepticism of atheists with the trustingness of the faithful. It wants to ride the 5,000-year-old horse of monotheism, as it were, to learn from and enjoy its stories, images, rituals, and metaphors. But it does not want to feed the horse, possess it, or be possessed by it. And so detractors might ask, is it fair that the theology of theopraxy gets to talk about God, but not actually hold to any God any believer would recognize as God? Is it exploitative for the theology of theopraxy to assume the pulpit, proclaiming that God is this and God is that, when the audience contains people in whom any talk of God blooms with biblical or Quranic imagery? In short, is it legitimate to capture the emotion of one set of beliefs and transfer them onto another on the back of similar language? The answer, I think, is yes. Many, if not all, cultural innovations involve giving old words new meaning. Consider how art was redefined in the 20th century, or substance in science. Indeed, hardly a word in the dictionary means what it meant originally, and hardly a word we use today does not benefit from the weight, the shading, given to it by its past meanings. The word God is caught up by this process too. God has been a contested term for a very long time, not only between religions, but also within each religion's own scholarly communities, each of whom use it in respect of the others, borrowing their opponents' meanings even as they propound their own, or new ones. Consider the marvelous Christian construction of the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or the Kabbalah's 10 sefirot, or aspects of God, scholars of which love to insist that this God is actually identical of the one God of Genesis. God's name, image, and preferred modus operandi change even across the span of the Bible, as I've said. On the other hand, the meanings of words ought not to be up for grabs with every use of them. We should avoid anything like this Alice in Wonderland extreme. And yet we must keep open for debate and for improvement the meanings of words that mean a great deal to us and continue to give us trouble. Words like value, fairness, democracy, person, truth, or justice. These are words whose deeper meanings squirm away from us as we approach them. Indeed, this is why circles of guardians, some quite fierce, gather around certain interpretations of these words to defend them and keep them stable. All the more is this true of God. The theology of theopraxy sets up a new circle, as it were, helping to defend older meanings of God against atheism, up to a point, while offering, in the effort to make peace with all, one more thing that the word God could mean in this day and this age. But enough of this analogy. The debate as to the true meaning of the word God, which is also the debate as to God's nature, will, character, role, and so on, goes on in theological circles today. Indeed, today perhaps with more sophistication and urgency than ever before. For thinking people, for spiritual seekers, and for the truly devout of every religion, the meaning of the word God is not settled and cannot be. The theology of theopraxy would put a seal on the state of affairs and say, Amen. The word God, if not God, is the greatest still evolving idea humans ever had. Reflections 12. Beliefs That Work. God does not destroy or kill, he only heals. God does not punish or put down, he only lifts up. This is what our theology holds. Here we reflect upon how exactly God lifts us up. A young man, let us call him Peter, dies tragically. Traditional faith consoles grievers by allowing them to say to each other, God gave Peter such life as he enjoyed at all, and for this we should be grateful. They are further consoled by the belief that God had something larger and better in mind for the long run, a plan for Peter's family or for all humankind, which required God to shorten Peter's earthly life. To David Hume, as to Karl Popper, as to any skeptic, such consolations are deeply problematic, if only because no conceivable actual event could disconfirm their truth. If whatever happens is God's will, then whatever happens is by definition good, and so it must be good that Peter died, that Kennedy was shot, that the World Trade Center came down, that Lisbon had an earthquake, and so on and on. The theology of theopraxy here sides with neither the believers nor the skeptics. It sides with William James and the pragmatists. It makes room for beliefs that work, which is to say, for beliefs that, when acted upon, effect change in the world, whether or not they, the beliefs, pass stringent tests of rationality or correspondence with facts. Not all beliefs that work are good, of course, as we discussed in Explanation 7. The point is that beliefs that work to produce goodness are worthier than better supported beliefs that work to produce harm. If people derive genuine comfort from traditional belief in God, if they are helped to recommit to preserving, honoring, and promoting all life, not the least their own, the sooner, then the false ideas about God upon which they rest, i.e. that God knows all, intends all, created the universe, is wholly good, is productive of God, and in that sense are not false at all. Of course, There is one consequence that in the long run might be bad for families other than Peter's, namely perpetuation of the belief that God causes inexplicable, unfair, and untimely deaths, which belief in turn can support irrational, so be it, fatalism on the one hand, and equally rational, God will protect me, risk-taking, which is actually fatalism again, on the other. One ends up with a population divided between the resigned and the reckless. Best, without a doubt, is holding only to good-doing truths. But there are cases, I have said, where good-doing falsehoods are to be preferred over harm-doing truths. This is why the theology of theopraxy's understanding of God in the case of grief, say, must be able to offer equal or greater long-term healing and return to life. I think it can, based in part on Reflections 17 and 18. But if it could not, or could not for certain people, then it must concede that for these people, traditional faith is better and truer to God than the theology of theopraxy, at least in the matter of recovering from grief. The same might be said of petitionary prayer, and prayer in general. To wit, if the effectiveness of prayer depends on the strength and literalness of one's faith in God along traditional lines, and if the theology of theopraxy which brackets that literalness thereby undoes the effectiveness of that prayer, then either the theology of theopraxy must cede by failure of its own mission, or it must show with a plausibility at least as great as that which establishes the effectiveness of traditional prayer, that the good that flows from subscribing to theopraxy more than compensates, by, for example, lessening the longer-run social harms that same belief might have. For atheists, proof of the effectiveness of prayer would not prove that God exists. It would only prove that faith in God and trust in the effectiveness of prayer can make some prayers effective, maybe. Subscribers to theopraxy cannot be so summary in judgment. The difference between their view and the atheist's is subtle, but significant. To wit, the theology of theopraxy agrees that prayer to God can change things for the better, and that this is one proof of God's existence. But it does not go along with the traditional believer's notion of what sort of God is thus proven to exist. Even if it were shown that only prayer, premised on belief in a singular, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good creator God was effective, it would still not prove that there was a singular, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good creator God. It might just as easily prove that the tender and real God who dwells in the human heart and in human hands, the God who is the newest and weakest force in the universe, requires in some people massive amplification in order to be actualized. But in others, God does not require such amplification. We know that for sure. For them, theological hyperbole is counterproductive and off-putting, not to mention logically troubling. These people are candidates for the conscious practice of theopraxy, and their prayers, if they did not take a different form, would be offered in a different spirit. From the perspective of theopraxy, one can see that a habitually prayerful attitude towards life is not generally a good thing. Chronic reliance on prayer, in the trust that of prayer's effectiveness, even in the hope of its effectiveness, can breed both passivity and overconfidence, a problem we noted earlier, especially when it causes one to be unwilling to devise plan Bs, on the grounds that if one made such plans, it would prove lack of faith in God, which very lack would cause God not to effect plan A, which is what one was praying for. This is a test of God, not of faith, and all creeds agree, God will not tolerate being tested. Reflections 13, Idolatry. This is from Exodus 20, 4-5. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth? Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. No Christian, Jew, or Muslim imagines themselves idolatrous. Those that seem to worship graven images, I'm thinking here of Roman Catholicism, are quick to point out that carvings of the crucifixion and statues of Mary are icons, not idols, designed to be prayed with, not to. Relative to such purely metaphysical conceptions of God as Spinoza's Deus sive natura, God or nature, Hegel's absolute spirit or Whitehead's process, however, all three of the Abrahamic religions are idolatrous to some extent, and are thus, arguably, in partial violation of their own second commandment. As though fearful of this possibility, representatives of the three religions like to compare themselves to each other on this score. In the eyes of Protestants, for example, Catholicism represents a lapse into paganism and idolatry. We have seen how Catholics reply. In the eyes of Jews and Muslims, however, all Christians fall into idolatry, first because prayer directed to Jesus Christ, a mortal, is made equivalent to prayer directed to God, and second because Jesus is often and God is sometimes represented pictorially. Neither Judaism nor Islam permits graphic or sculptural representations of God. Devout Jews may not even spell out God's name in writing or print. Jews find the extreme veneration of the person of Muhammad by Muslims disturbing, close to being idolatrous. In fact, Muslims do not believe that Muhammad was anything but a man, albeit a prophet, and accordingly, Muhammad himself is never prayed to. Lest one imagine that Judaism is free from idolatry, let it be noted that Orthodox and Hasidic Jews hold a certain book, the Torah, to be the very tree of life, and treats all physical copies of it with such reverence that they could be accused of religious fetishism, if not idolatry, as could conservative Muslims for their extreme veneration of the Quran as an object, and their obedience to all too human mullahs. Then again, for all three, it is from the pages of the Bible and Quran that God speaks. It is in and among these pages that we read how God sees, that God is angry, that God is pleased or jealous. What does it matter that these very human images of God are graven in ink on paper rather than carved in thicker wood? One could also point to the extreme sacredness of several physical sites in the Middle East, from the Western or Wailing Wall and Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem to the Kaaba in Mecca. Because idolatry quite clearly permits of degrees, the Second Commandment's injunction against idolatry might best be read as a minimizing principle, something like, believe in me as directly as possible, that is, with as little idolatry as you can manage and still believe. This effectively is how it is taken by missionary Catholics, who often defend the Church's use of icons of Christ and the Virgin Mary in certain countries as a significant reduction in the number of nature gods, household gods, half-human figurines and totems that would otherwise be worshipped by the locals. But truth be told, all the great Western religions construct an accessible mental, if not physical, image of an all-wise, eternal, supreme being, King of kings, radiant, glorious in justice and love. And for this, they are all idolatrous. Indeed, when God is addressed univocally as the omniscient, omnipotent, and benevolent governor of the world, when God is petitioned for this and that but hardly ever comes through for reasons of his own, when God is thought of as jealous or desiring or angry or needful of praise and yet cannot be called into account, when God could have a son by a human woman, when God can speak, send messages, or perform miracles, then arguably we have a worship more idolatrous for being so blind and anthropomorphizing than the worship of a wooden statuette, which can at least be thrown out the window. What a mess we have made of our image of God under cover of being metaphorical. One wonders, on the other hand, what would happen if religions ever succeeded in eliminating the idolatry within them completely. That is, if they eliminated all human-made and human-like images of God, verbal as well as sculptural, musical as well as graphic. Would religions become so intellectualized and or intuitivized that their moral force would be drained? Would personal accountability to anything more than the law of the land be harder to sustain? Would spontaneous feelings of gratitude for everything go undirected, without nameable recipient? Would ancient religious texts and their naive struggles to conceptualize God be swept away in scorn? Would one be left with nature worship, albeit in the modern form of Buddhism-tinged deism or process? One hopes not, although for many it already has. We should consider the possibility that for a religion to be religion, and for God the Word to refer to God, some trace of idolatry must remain, like the impurity in an oyster around which a pearl grows. The challenge is to allow sufficient idolatry, but no more than is necessary, to grow around our sensus de divinitatis, without becoming its focus instead. We shall explore one way this can be done in the next chapter.